because we care. We ask all the questions that others don't dare. We're dads on the air. We're back, we're dads on the air.
And welcome back to Dads on the Air this Tuesday, 23rd of March, 2010. A bright sunny day in Sydney, and it's Bill Cable from Mediate Now. And with me in the studio, Ian Purdy from ianpurdy.com.
Yes, good morning, everybody. Good morning, Bill.
Good morning, Ian. So in today's show, we've got a second part of an interview by our own Peter van der Voorde with Rick, not his real name. But you might remember the story was Rick, the extraordinary story, where he has spent time in jail, most recently for sending a card to his daughter. Anyway, we'll hear a bit more of this this story when we get to that interview.
Yeah, shocking story.
And in the meantime, there's a lot been happening in the news, and a lot of stories we can get our teeth into. One follow-up story is involving fathers and families in the States. You might recall we had an interview with the founder of Fathers and Families, Dr. Ned Holstein, a couple of weeks ago. Our fathers and families are working in the States on the legislature, and fathers and families and their allies have recently introduced a wide-ranging package of California bills, which include child custody reform, child support reform, protection from family court financial abuses, and others. Sounds like these problems are pretty common around the world. But the advantage that fathers and families have is that they have a full-time lobbyist as well as an associate, and they're working within the capital of a major state, namely California, to get these changes through. They've got some scores on the board already. They were able to scuttle a bill, AB 612, that would have banned target parents of parental alienation from raising parental alienation as an issue in their cases. And that was only last year. In 2004 and 2006, they helped defeat bills that would have allowed custodial parents free rein to move children far away from their non-custodial parents. And one that they're working on now, which is a particular concern, it may only affect a small part of the community, but this is to do with soldiers serving in Iraq or anywhere else around the world, and many soldiers lose contact or contact with their children in a situation where they might have court orders that they can call their children. They can remain in contact, but what's been happening is that when they make their telephone call at the court specified time, nobody picks up the phone. Letters are written, they never reach the children. So the Fathers and Families is working to deal with this problem by granting by putting in laws that will allow grandparents, step-parents and extended families the ability to exercise a deployed soldier's normal parenting time. This way there's a double benefit, because it preserves the loving bonds with the deployed parents, but it also protects the important relationships that children share with their grandparents, step-parents and other extended family. So this is one good way of getting around that particular problem.
Yeah, but it still doesn't help the father who's overseas in Afghanistan or wherever actually get to speak to his children, and it doesn't help the children get to speak to their father. I mean, yeah, there is a good side to it, but I mean, I don't think it's a great outcome, really. I mean, it's basically pandering to a mother who you know won't answer the phone and you know won't give the kids the mail that the court's ordered her that she should. I mean, I don't see it as a great solution. But hey, I guess it's a kind of step, sort of towards where the right direction might be.
That's right, and. If we come back then to the situation of orders, and they're also working on a rebuttable presumption that when a military parent is deployed, upon his or her return, child custody and visitation orders will revert to the original order. So once again, if the other parent has been doing things in court while the one's over fighting for his country, all that will revert as soon as the parent who's been deployed arrives back on the scene. So they're working in this area, which is and getting some results, which is good to see.
Yeah, it's a little bit positive, I suppose. Another article here in in this morning's Telegraph, Too Few Good Men is the headline. Bruce McDougall has written alarm at lack of role models for primary school teachers. Bruce McDougall writes, male teachers are fast becoming an endangered species in the state's public primary schools, their numbers threatening to fall below 20%. The number of male teachers in government primary schools has plummeted by 478 in the 6 years to 2009 as classrooms become even more female-dominated. Catholic primary schools have even lower proportions of men, 9.2% of Sydney Diocese and 13.4% in Parramatta. This is a pretty shocking state of affairs, I think. My son went to Clovelly Public School, and it was a girls' school, and we used to talk about it being a girls' school. There were 23 girls in the class. There were 7 boys. He'd never had a male teacher. There were no males in sight, basically. The deputy principal was a male, but he was strongly metrosexual, heading towards the other direction, certainly not your classic male role model. And I personally felt that it definitely impacted on my son's education. I mean, basically, he just didn't get one. The boys were treated as if they were a nuisance, a problem that was sort of stopping the girls from learning. And, you know, they suffered, they were punished for being boys fairly often. And, we got all these reports, flowery reports that sort of said, you know, the work was, you know, they didn't come up with A's, B's or C's or all that archaic stuff that we had in my day. They kind of had all these flowery little, you know, things, not criticizing the children and trying to point out what they were good at. But when I sat my boy down and, you know, asked him to spell some words or asked him if he could read something or tried to get him to add up a list of figures or do anything that you would imagine that a primary school age child could do, he failed abysmally. Fortunately, we've got him in a boys' school now, which is chock-a-block with male role models. He's loving it. He's absolutely adoring going to school, having hated it, having dreaded school and tried to make excuses and dragging his feet and not wanting to go. Now he's loving it. There's male role models. He's learning what it is to be a man from men, and it's doing him a lot of good. Just going on with this article, under an election commitment, the government, the Rudd government, pledged to increase the numbers of male teachers, especially in primary schools, and target male higher school certificate students. But the drive failed to produce dividends, and education chiefs now claim quality rather than gender is more important in the classroom. Well, they would, wouldn't they? That's just making an excuse for their own failure. One Year 6 public student said yesterday she did not have a male teacher until her final primary year, while parents at a small country school were distressed about the transfer of their only male teacher. You know, and it's not that the women teachers aren't doing a great job, but the fact of the matter is that boys and girls learn differently. Girls learn a bit like by talking about things, boys learn from doing things, and in a female-dominated environment, doing things tends to come second to talking about them, and the boys just simply don't learn. And we have the shocking situation where boys are falling behind in all areas of academic achievement. They're graduating less frequently from university, which means now the girls are getting all the higher paid jobs despite the so-called glass ceiling. And the boys are disadvantaged in our school. I don't think there can be any doubt about that. What say you, Bill?
Yes, well, I guess the first step is an awareness of the problem, and I'm pleased to say that I've spoken to at least one principal at a school in country New South Wales, in Armidale, who, having recognised the problem, made an effort to actually recruit a male for junior kindergarten children. So that was one positive step, but as I say, the first thing is to be aware that there's a problem.
Yeah, well, I think there definitely is a problem. And it's impacting on boys on all level. I mean, especially boys who come from a home where they don't get to see their father. You know, even if their father is off in Afghanistan from our last article. And, you know, I mean, boys need men as role models. It's that simple. All of the studies show this, and the fact that if they don't have a father at home, if they don't, you know, if mum doesn't have a steady long-term relationship with a responsible male, who is in the home and, you know, espousing male values and basically being a man, which means a lot more than just drinking beer and farting, then boys are disadvantaged, and it's that simple. Anyway, look, here's a shocking case. This is also in this morning's Telegraph. Dad fled, leaving his family behind. Michael Noon, or No One, depending on how you want to pronounce his name. Meet a low candidate for worst father of the year. A man who crashed a stolen car after a police chase and left his wife and 11-year-old son in the hands of police. The 38-year-old Gosford man led police on a chase after first trying to run them down. After hitting speeds of 90 kilometres an hour through suburban Central Coast streets on Friday night, he lost control of the car on a bend, hit a tree and fled the scene. Now, what a low act. I mean, a father, that's shocking. That is a shocker. We here at Dad's on the Air condemn this person. He's barely fit for the title father. People like that, because the feminists jump on a case like this, it ends up giving us all a bad name.
Yes, I mean, we've got to remember our focus is on the welfare of the children, and then the parents have to get in. We're also interested in their interest and their benefit as well, of course, because we want them to have that good relationship with the children. But you do hear about some stories from both sides of the gender gap. Just following up from a story we did a couple of weeks ago with Ken Thompson and his son Andrew, who's been
abducted. That was the abduction case.
Yes, by his mother. Andrew, he hasn't seen Andrew now for some years. The family court is now acknowledging that this is a major problem, and the federal police, I mean, contrary to what Ken said, where he found it very difficult to get the federal police interested and involved, I'd like to think that with a bit more focus on what's going on, that the federal police will become more involved and will start achieving results. But in a study by the Sun Herald, an article produced on the 14th of March 2010, Sue Hewitt has reported that there are 700,000 children in Australia who firstly have no meaningful contact with one of their non-custodial parents, mostly their fathers. And of that figure, I think the figure we heard was something like 300,000 abducted children. The number of these abductions has spiked in recent times, alarming authorities who warn that offenders who abduct children face a year in jail. The court, as a last resort, will issue publication orders, but it has to remember that normally it's illegal to publish details of children involved in custody disputes. So that's the first hurdle you have to get over, is that to get the court to make some order to allow publication to increase the chances of finding these children. These publication orders follow lengthy court battles and police investigations usually. This year there have been 57 recovery orders, which is the step before a publication order. And yet the risk to the child is so high in these situations. This has been reported on by child psychologist Michael Carr Gregg, who said kidnapped children could be traumatised, and the worst affected are those children between the ages of 5 and 14 because they need that consistency. Kidnappings were destabilising for children, could completely break the bond with the parent waiting for them at home.
Yeah, well, I mean, kidnapping a kid, I mean, it's got to be bad from all angles. I mean, no matter who does it, and it is a defiance of law and order and whatever court stuff they've gone on. It's a sign of desperation. I mean, you've really just got to feel sorry for everybody who's in a situation like that. I mean, even the perpetrator, you know, like they're obviously to get themselves to the point where they basically just steal the child. They're on the run. I mean, what quality of life do they have after that? You know what I mean? It's just a shocking mess that these people find themselves in, and you know, nobody benefits, especially not the children.
And just on that, the strange part is that the family court will not intervene, the federal police will not intervene in abductions unless there is either a court order or family court proceedings have started. So if the abducting parent makes an early decision, gets away, they'll get away scot-free.
Gonski. Nothing you can do about it. Okay, well, this is Joe Cocker.
Yeah.
What would you do if I sang out of tune? Would you stand up and walk out on me? Lend me your ears and I'll sing you a song. I will try not to sing out of key. Just wanna get by with my friend. Keep on getting high with my friend. Keep trying with my friend. Well, hold on with my friend. What do I do when my love is away?
Does it worry you to be alone?
Once in a while, but how do I feel at the end of the day?
Are you sad because you're on your own?
I try not to get sad if I am my friend.
Oh, bless you.
They grow so fast. You have to cherish every moment.
Please, Daddy.
You have a right to be involved in the life of your child.
Dad's in Distress, 1-300-853-437.
We're back with Dad's on the Air.
Today we bring you part two of an in-depth two-part interview with a father who has been jailed several times for such dangerous crimes as sending a birthday card to his daughter and for daring to watch his son play school sports. This father's plight clearly exemplifies everything that is wrong with the worldwide family justice system, now a multi-billion dollar industry of which the symbolic head is the family court. We sincerely hope that this father's experience is another wake-up call to all those mothers and fathers who think this could never happen to them. We hope everyone seriously reassess their perceived legal rights as a parent, because the truth is, you have none. And I repeat, parents do not have a legal parenting right. Unfortunately, the mistaken belief in these perceived rights cause many parents to seek justice in a family justice system which does not offer due process of law and is more to do with serving the economic well-being of thousands of meddling bureaucrats growing into a multi-billion dollar worldwide industry. Unless you have made a preemptive first strike or have $1 million to spare, the family court will do nothing for you except sever your relationship with your children and confiscate your family wealth, thereby stealing your kids' inheritance. It is a social engineering hellhole to be avoided at all cost. Ask anyone who's been there. They will all tell you the end result will leave you emotionally and economically destitute. The stealing of children is a crime against humanity, and fighting this crime in the family courts will only make your situation impossible. If you decide to go this way and persist in seeking equality, justice and your human rights, it will cause you to spiral into the devastating situation this dad finds himself in. Rick, not his real name for legal reasons, joins us to tell us his story in the hope it will alert people of how easy it is to spiral into an impossible situation which severely punishes you for daring to attempt to remain in your children's lives. We're back speaking with disenfranchised, separated father, Rick, not his real name for legal reasons.
In the meantime, my children had been legally, judicially kidnapped, and there wasn't much else I could do. My son was playing footy on the oval next to where I live, so I dropped in to see him train on a couple of Friday nights in succession. On the second night, the wallopers turned up and started pushing me around and telling me I was breaking intervention order, and
The intervention order said you couldn't go, within a certain...
Well, I think it was within 200 yards initially.
200 yards.
200 yards, yeah.
Right.
And I was probably 200 yards away anyway. But my wife, for some reason, she was in a different car, and I didn't realise she was there. And the third week I turned up, and I'd almost forgotten about it, and I was going around this roundabout, and I suddenly remembered, so I went back. And unbeknownst to me, There were two policemen in a plain an unmarked car waiting for me, and two plainclothes policemen waiting for me.
Waiting for you to turn up to watch your son play football?
Yeah, watch my son play footy. Now, I couldn't see my wife's car there, so I walked into the oval, and I was still about 200 yards away from them all.
Yes.
And I did something very silly. I rang up the local Wallopers shop and said, "Oh, you better get down to the oval. There's a dangerous man on the loose." And she knew who it was. She said, "Oh, no, no, no." Anyway, I walked outside the ground again because I was just to make sure. I couldn't go to a public place, you know.
Right.
So I made sure I was outside the fence, so I couldn't be accused of being in a public place. And I was there for about half an hour. I had a yak to a friend of mine I saw, and he walked off. And all of a sudden, I turned around, and these two wallopers jumped out of the car and came running up to me and handcuffed me. And I recognised one because he'd arrested me about 5 months previously when I'd written a letter to my wife.
Mm-hmm.
I've been arrested a couple of times for writing letters to my wife, and this time...
Were they abusive letters?
Oh, of course not. No.
But
urging her, begging her to come to her senses and, well, reconcile. You know, I didn't want a divorce.
But you had orders that you weren't allowed to contact her, is that...
Well, I didn't realise... I thought we lived in a free country, Peter. I didn't realise the government could block communication between consenting adults, you know, it's just...
But she had a bit of paper to say that.
Oh, apparently, yeah. Yeah, of course. There's no, like, dog licenses. You just go and renew them every year, those individuals.
Yes.
And this bloke, he'd barged into my house at bloody 7:15 one morning and thrown me in the back of the paddy wagon and arrested me for writing a letter. So I recognised him. They handcuffed me. It was a Friday afternoon. They took me down to the local cells and locked me in the cells for the weekend. Three nights in the cells. Now, that was a... Well, it was a bloody shock, I tell you.
This was for turning up at your children?
Yeah, for watching my son play football.
Mm.
And they were very long 3 days.
Absolutely.
And I was in there with a few other blokes, like five, I think, altogether. And my immediate conclusion was that you meet a far higher class of person in the cells than you do in the divorce courts. Anyway, the lawyer turned up on Monday and said, what do you want? I said, I'm not pleading guilty to this. And he said, well, all right, we have to be in for another couple of days while I prepare a case. But if you want to plead guilty now, you'll get out today with a good behaviour bond or a suspended sentence, I think it was.
Mm-hmm.
And, because you've got a good magistrate. Now, I was in the Heidelberg lockup, and the Heidelberg court is apparently notorious for, crazed feminist magistrates. You know, they're all over the place, and I managed to strike a reasonable one. So I got railroaded into pleading guilty, of course, no jury around. Had my wrist slapped and let out, and with a suspended sentence. Now, I was damn sure I wasn't going to go through that again, and that was it. Although, about 4 months later, my wife had applied for another intervention order, or extension of the existing intervention order. So I thought I'd go to court and contest it.
Mm-hmm.
Now, I went to court, and I was doing it myself, and her barrister was in there, and we were hanging around waiting for the magistrate to finish her breakfast. And I said to her lawyer, you should tell your clients, she's jeopardising the school fees of this stuff, because I didn't realise, my father had been paying the school fees on the quiet, and I didn't realise this.
Mm-hmm.
And I said, you know, tell your church, and he just sort of didn't say anything. And my wife pulled a face at me over his shoulder. And then I said to the barrister, tell your clients they should buy themselves some dresses because they look like a couple of old dykes in those trousers, which I thought was, a joke I'd been thinking of for a while, and pretty harmless. And anyway, I'd been inadvertently scribbling on the table too. I'd written Baskerville's phrase, a legally unimpeachable citizen, and then played a bit of noughts and crosses. And a couple of the official guerrillas came up to me and started hassling me about writing on the desecrating court property. And I was a bit flustered by this stage. I thought, I'm in no state. I won't be able to do myself justice here. So I walked out. And sure enough, the intervention order was granted in my absence. Mm-hmm. And it was one for life. It was barred from seeing you until further orders. So I thought, well... And then later on, a month or two later, I got a call from the local walloper who'd been assigned, my case officer, saying they wanted to interview me about breach of the intervention order. I said, what are you talking about? He said, you allegedly spoke to your wife in court. That's a breach of the intervention order.
So Rick, what's going through your mind at this time? Were you thinking, is it going to get? It can't get any worse. Or did you give any thoughts to alternative action? Or?
No, I'd learned about 2 years previously never to say it can never get any worse. But, my first thought was, I'm looking at the jail sentence here, this is bloody outrageous. Well, I'd read all Baskerville stuff, so I was wising up to what was going on.
Yes.
Anyway, I thought I'd go to the county court and try and appeal against this intervention order. So I went to the county court, do it myself, of course. There was another due process fiasco. My wife got up in court and gave a very convincing, said, oh, he's got an explosive temper, Your Honour.
Mm.
And everyone in the court looked daggers at me.
Yes, yes.
Of course, there's no evidence to back that up. But this old senile judge, I hope that's not a tautology because it's a precondition for being made a judge, isn't it? You've got to be senile. But he...
Yeah, sometimes.
He said that Well, I think it is. I mean, in every other sphere of industry, they pension you off or give you a gold watch, but in the law, they make you a judge. It's amazing.
It's pretty easy there in family law because there's no due process of law. So
oh,
the palace of perjury.
Mm. Anyway, this bloke, he knocked me back. He refused. He knocked back my appeal and then asked her lawyer what costs he had in mind. Now, this was a day's, or it was a morning's work, and this, the first figure I heard mentioned was
$32,000.
Oh, and I sort of, anyway, even this was a bit too much for the old bloke in the wig, so he said, oh, blah, blah, blah. Anyway, he settled on $13,000. He ordered costs of $13,000 against me for having the temerity of appealing against an intervention order.
Which
are bloody unconstitutional anyway, you know. Mm,
yes.
So anyway, that was that. And then, meanwhile, this, I'd managed to put this walloper off. I'd say, oh, well, look, I'm going to Sydney. I can't come and see you. And, this, and he was always on holidays. He must have years, darling. So whenever I'd say, look, I'll come and see you in 2 weeks' time, he was on holidays. So I kept managed to put it off. And I went and saw them. Then he let me know they were going to charge me. They were going to charge me with that and charge me with court property. So I thought to myself, well, I'm not hanging around here. I'm going to shift house so where they don't know where I live and not be vulnerable to this sort of stuff. So I shifted out of my house. And this gave me a false sense of security because then I sent a few more letters off to my wife saying, you know, you can't be serious wanting a person to go to jail for talking to someone in a public place. And also, you know, just trying to tell her what the damage she was doing to the children. And I can't remember what else. I was also, while all this was going on, I was sending texts to my elder daughter's mobile phone, wishing them happy birthdays and all this sort of stuff, you know, you usually do.
And how old were the kids then, by then?
Well, my elder daughter's just turned 17, so she would have been 15, 16.
Mm, old enough to sort of realise what's going on.
And then I sort of shifted house. Now, and I finally made an agreement to go down and pick up my summons, but I shifted out of my house, and then I went into state for a month or so, and then went back, and while I was... Now, I had no idea that you could have a warrant for an arrest issued without a summons. I thought you'd have to be summoned first or something. But anyway, I went back to Melbourne. I was living with a friend of mine, and while he was away on holidays... And what happened? I was one Sunday afternoon. I was I was still naive, and I'd parked my car out the front of his house. One rain, I got in the habit of parking it around the, or I'd hidden it just in case. But on a very wet day, I'd parked it out in front of the house and gone inside because I didn't want to get wet. And my wife must have seen the car and rang up the wallopers and reported me. This is how deranged she's become.
Mm.
Anyway, they turned up looking for me. Said they had a warrant for my arrest. Fortunately, I wasn't there. But so I went and stayed with a friend for a couple of nights, but didn't hear any more of it. So sort of slinked back to the original place and just keeping a close eye out, you know. And it's amazing how often you see police cars when you're sort of looking for them.
Yes.
The other thing, apart from having that appeal knocked back, he'd also increased the boundary from 200 yards to 500 yards, this county court judge.
It's metres, I suppose.
500 metres, yeah. Which I used to go to the local library to read the Sunday papers, which was in the same street as my old house, and was probably about 201 yards from the house. So I remember saying to him, well, hang on, I can't go. That's going to cut out my library, you know. And I wanted to ask him whether he'd take my library books back for me, but I was a bit worried he might jug me for contempt or something. But anyway, look, I used to go to the library. I thought, oh, this is ridiculous. So I'd go to the library and just, you know, I didn't think I was doing any harm there. And then I'd wander down and look up the street, see if I could see my children and wander off. And then one Tuesday in February, I was parked in the street because all this while I was living about a mile away from, or less than a mile away from my family. And I'd parked my car around the street and I'd been to the library and I was just walking out of the library and walking down the street. I noticed it was in a little cul-de-sac. I noticed the police car come out of the cul-de-sac. And so that's funny. And I was just walking. I kept walking, and I looked around. And I saw him. He was going back in there. He'd done a circle. He was going back in there, which I thought was peculiar too. So And I walked down there, and I noticed the police car was in the car park, and so I just kept walking and walked around the corner, and I still wasn't clued up to the fact that they were looking for me. I just didn't have the criminal mind, I don't think. And I sat in the park bench reading a paper, and I saw them edge around the corner in the car, and I was wondering whether I should bolt or just sit there. And I thought they might have been coming around to see someone else. Anyway, they came and grabbed me and said, threw me in the back of the van, and this was in February, and I was in the cells for 10 days trying to get bail. Now, because I had a suspended sentence, and I was in front of this mad dog feminist magistrate, she wasn't going to give me bail. But a few friends of mine found the psychologist who did the report on my behalf. He ran the test. They dragged her in, and she got her to say, you know, play the game and say I had this syndrome and that syndrome. And this ridiculous magistrate said, oh, yeah, okay. So she gave me bail after 10 days. A part of which I had to report into the... I had to report in every day. I mean, there were guys wandering in. When I was in, there were guys being bailed for drug running, gun running, illegal guns. I can't remember now. They were just coming and going, like, you know, coming through the cells like that. Here was I. My charge has gone out to about 20, I think, now. Writing letters, sending birthday cards. When they grabbed me, they grabbed my phone, and they said, we're going to confiscate this phone. I said, why? They said, because there's a text message to your daughter on there. I said, well, there's never been a complaint lodged about that. He said, it doesn't matter. We're going to... So they grabbed my phone, wishing my elder daughter a happy birthday. 22 charges.
There's a crime, isn't there? There's a crime.
Shocking business, isn't it? Heinous, terrible.
It's like murder.
That's right. I mean, what is going on? Why are these people... These people should be... hanging from the nearest lamppost upside down.
Oh, I think history will show what's been going on.
Oh.
And we're documenting history.
Yeah.
You know, your story is not unique, unfortunately.
Mine is all too common.
I think you've discovered that when you ended up in jail, didn't you? That
someone told me, actually that was the next time, but
okay.
Anyway, I got bailed, and my bail conditions were pretty stringent. I had to report in every day, and I had to go and get therapy with my psychologist, which means going to have a yak and a cup of coffee and laughing at all these people, and also getting dragged off to a dreadful social worker, anger management bloke, who I'd encountered the year before as part of my... I had to go and see. Now, he ran this Uniting Church anger management thing. They railroad blokes out, you know. I didn't want to go and see him because I'd sat through his session once before and it was the biggest load of cobblers I've ever heard. But anyway, I got dragged out of there. I went and saw him, and he was trying to give me all this collective guilt, domestic violence rubbish, and I countered that by saying, well, you know, that's nonsense, and every individual is entitled to due process of the law. There's no such thing as collective guilt. He got a bit worked up about this, and he said, I don't want to see you again. And I thought, well, that bloody suits me, old son. But then he said... I said, well, hang on, this is part of my bail conditions. I don't want to go to jail. There was a hearing scheduled for May when I got the pleas or whatever, and I had to sit through it. So I got another session with him. I went back the next time, and he said, are you here because of a court order, or you're interested in behavioural change? And I said, well, court order, of course. He said, okay, that's it. There's nothing more we can do for you, which was good. I was happy as Larry. I could get out of there. Didn't have to pay him any more money. Didn't have to waste any more time with this charlatan.
Mm.
But in the meantime, a few weeks later, this letter addressed to my wife turned up at where the place I was living. They must have addressed it. And it was an amazing letter. I opened it. It was from a person of this anger management to my wife saying, dear so-and-so, we are very, after your husband was referred to us, we are very concerned about the safety of you and your children. I was absolutely gobsmacked. Was saying, and it was all these generalisations. One in particular, I remember saying, in our experience, men don't always tell the truth and don't always lie. It didn't make sense. It was just a nonsensical social work gibber.
Was he out of line sending that to your
wife?
He got a
female accomplice to do it. Oh, of course he was. He was well out of line. I would have thought that would be breaching privacy.
Yes. Contrary to their code of conduct.
That's right. No, he was well out of line. So a couple of months later, I wrote a spoof one back to him and her from each other or from the acquaintances of each other accusing the other of domestic violence themselves, which is the only way you can... Anyway, which I thought was amusing, but obviously yes. It didn't.
No, obviously not.
No.
You're listening to Dads on the Air, coming to you from 2GLF in Sydney, and don't forget the program will be available on our website later today at www.dadsontheair.net. My name's Peter Vandervoort, and I'm speaking with Rick, a separated father who has spent time in jail for sending a birthday card to his daughter. We'll be back after the break. Speaking with disenfranchised, separated father Rick, not his real name for legal reasons.
Now, the further twist in the tale was, I used to be in the habit of going up and playing golf most days. I'd go up as a public course in this parklands, and you can just climb over the fence and just, you know, play a few holes at night in the evening.
Yep.
And do a bit of chipping and putting and what have you. And I went up there on. I was going up there 6 or 7 days a week. And I went up there one Friday the 20th of March. I got up there with cars everywhere, and I couldn't work out what was going on. Anyway, I just drove down, and I could have a look to see if there's anywhere I could get on the course. I could see them coming down the first and the tenth holes and work out if there was much traffic around and where I could get on. But I was sitting in the car for about 5 minutes, and I decided that it was too busy. I wasn't going to get on. So I backed out and went round the other side of the course. Now, as I was going out, I saw this couple and a child walking down, and I suddenly remembered, oh, shit, this could be a school sports day today because it's this time of the year.
Mm.
So I thought, hell, that was lucky, and I got out of there and went round the other side of the course. Because I couldn't see the sports day. The golf course was separated from about 6 or 7 ovals by a road and all these trees and a couple of sports pavilions. And the sports day was always held on the far oval, and I couldn't see it. I couldn't see anything.
Mm.
Anyway, so I went round there and played golf, practiced my chipping and putting for an hour or two, then went home. Nothing happened. That was Friday night, nothing happened. Sunday night, I was in bed at 10:30. There was a knock on the door, and the person I was staying with answered the door, because I'd shifted house and I had to go, had to lodge a change of address with part of my bail application.
Yep.
And the Wallopers stormed in and said, "We want to see you about breach of intervention orders. What are you talking about?" I said, so I got dragged off to the cells at 10:30 at night. I go through the farce of getting a bail justice down there. He just, you know, laugh at you and refuse you. And ended up in the custody centre, in Melbourne custody centre, for about, I don't know, 10 days or so. Got in front of the same magistrate. She wouldn't hear me for about 5 days. Got taken out to the courts on three fruitless occasions. Had three people in the box, swore on the Bible that I was down there every day of the week, either playing golf or there's a walking track down there which everyone uses, and we go walking there too. And arguing that if indeed there was a breach, it was an unintentional breach, you know.
Yes.
And in fact, I didn't even get out of my car. But she was having none of it, this mad woman, and she refused me bail. And the consequence was the hearing was brought forward from May to the next week, but she was on holidays. So we went before the, and I had a legal aid bloke, and he said, well, by this time I'd spent 20 days in jail in the last couple of months.
Mm.
And he said, well, you've got a suspended sentence of 30 days. I'll get an indication.
Is this all this year, is it?
This year.
Yep.
He said, this was until about April the 1st.
Right.
He said, because you've done 20 days, you've got 30, and you've been suspended sentence of 30, you probably have to serve 10. If you do 10, you'll be out in 10 days. If you appeal against the refusal of bail, that'll take a couple of weeks. So you'll be out earlier anyway if you just do it. You know, they're the same old thing. You get railroaded into doing it, into pleading guilty. Anyway, it turned up. We got up there, and it turns out that time served doesn't count with a suspended sentence. So it was back to 30 days, whatever. But even so, well, you know, 30 days, it still looked as though it was going to be the quickest way out, because if the appeal took 3 weeks and the appeal was knocked back, your sentence wouldn't start until then anyway.
And you were locked up all the time?
Oh, yeah. I was locked up.
Yeah.
I was in the Melbourne Custody Centre with a bloke, with a guy who told me, who had done 11 years in South Australia for bank robbery, and told me that he thought 20% of the prison inmates were in there as a result of intervention orders. So anyway, the upshot was I had to plead guilty to playing golf, and I got sentenced to 30 days, which I spent in the, with another suspended sentence added on, which I didn't realise was going to happen either. Spent 30 days in the Melbourne Custody Centre, which is a bloody hellhole, the Melbourne Assessment Prison, and then the Port Phillip Prison, which are the last two of maximum security jobs. So that's that. Now, since I got out, while I was in there, actually, I got a letter from Legal Aid saying a different wad of wallopers wanted to talk to me about breaching an intervention order the psychologist had got on me. And so, you know, there's the whole thing. There's no due process involved. And I was a bit worried they might just grab me when I walked out and refuse me bail again. So I thought, oh, this is ridiculous. And I went and saw a lawyer, and another lawyer, and he said, don't go and see him. You're under no obligation to go and see them, which suited me, so I didn't go and see them. And on the fifth night I was out, they swooped on my old address at 10:30 at night again, looking for me. And then they came back another night, the next night, and they turned up at a friend of mine, interstate country town. They turned up at his place looking for me.
Mm.
Now, this is all on the basis of allegedly ringing a secretary and asking for some information or something. This is due process of the law.
And what about child support? Are you forced to... are they hounding you for that as well?
Of course. One of the things, when I was with my wife, I was trading, I was speculating with commodities, and we were doing it with capital, was sort of tied up in the house, but that all went west, so I lost my livelihood as a result of all this business. I went and did a bit of courier driving for a bloke, and he started getting hassled by the the divorce subsidy people, and they were ringing him all hours, night and day, ringing him in meetings, and it got too much for him, and he said, well, look, I can't put up with this. We're going to have to, bring our arrangement to an end. So I lost the job briefly because of these people. Then I thought, well, I'll go and get on the old King Cole, which I did.
Mm.
Well, I had to go and do because I didn't have any money. And then they can see I'm on the King Cole, and I go and get my job back. So I went and did that. So I got on the King Cole. So they forced me onto bloody King Cole, basically.
Mm.
So I've been on that for, I don't know, a year or so. And then I did a bit of study and got off and back on. And so they take it out of there. At one stage, they took some money out. They helped themselves to my bank account.
Yes.
About 4 years ago. And they did the same thing again when I was in jail. They took some money out of my bank account.
Mm.
Now, I mean, there's always ways around these things to stop government flunkies stealing your money.
Mm.
And I've put them into practice, but I couldn't do anything while I was in jail, so they got some then.
Yes.
And there's something else I wanted to say about all that too.
Because that's another government agency that sends a lot of fathers into trauma.
Well, the whole point is the greater percentage of these fathers haven't sought a divorce. They've had a divorce imposed upon them.
Mm. Mm.
And then these flunkies claim the right to their money.
Mm.
It's totalitarianism.
Mm. Yeah,
it is totalitarianism.
So what do you think needs to change?
Well, the law, due process of the law, has got to be followed. I mean, in Western democracies, everyone is entitled to be left alone by the law unless they're accused of a crime. But family law stands that supposition on its head. Now, you can't have a family law. I mean, divorce is marriage is the only contract which you get rewarded for breaking. Mm. So it's an abuse of power. It's an abuse of legislative power. And as I said earlier, no one ever relinquishes power voluntarily. So it's going to take a hell of a fight
to overthrow the
current regime.
Yes.
Now whether this fight, I remember Baskerville was often quoting G.K. Chesterton, the English journalist, who predicted in the 1920s or 30s that one day people would have to fight their governments to retain control of their children.
Mm, really?
Now, that was a very prophetic utterance, and as Baskerville says, that time has come.
Mm.
So, I can't see it's going to take some sort of bloody civil disorder, war, I reckon, because how long are people going to put up with this?
They have for the last 35 years now.
Well, that's right. Yeah. But, I mean, I think people are starting to... this is why Baskerville was so good. I mean, he's got the academic credentials. Mm. He's got the legal credentials.
But the mainstream media is still not listening to people like him.
Of course not. But the mainstream media is ideologically beholden to feminism.
Yes,
feminism is... The justice system has become politicised, and family law is just a tacit conspiracy between the feminists, the legal parasites, and the psychotherapy frauds. And
yes.
until that's throttled and drowned, nothing's ever going to happen.
How long is it since you've seen your kids now, Rick?
Over three and a half years.
Wow.
And it'll be a miracle if I ever see them again.
And do you think your kids know what you've been put through, and are they aware of what you've been doing and what you've experienced?
I doubt it. They might have been told I'm a criminal and I've gone to jail, but I've got no idea.
And your kids are also now isolated from your parents and from other family members. The whole paternal side of their family is lost, isn't it?
Of course.
So finally, Rick, what sort of advice would you like to give to all those dads out there who are still under the impression that it could never happen to them?
I don't think there is any advice. I mean, there is no due legal process. You've got to realise you're wandering into a branch of organised crime. And the only practical advice I could give you is to find yourself a mistress, or get yourself a mistress before it happens. So you've got, okay. So you've got someone to keep you warm and occupied. Yeah. And honestly, I think that the best advice is to throw any legal letters in the bin, because the whole point of the law, the whole business of the law is designed to make business for itself. And I think you've got to try and starve the business and not respond, and which means you've got to be prepared to walk away from your children for a few months, which no one is prepared to do, of course.
But, that's, they count on you
course,
not doing
that's
that.
Dead right. That's dead right. That's why you need a mistress.
Okay.
So you can take your mind off them.
Well, that's one way. I would have also thought that, it, you know, for people that think that it could never happen to them, they should think twice and maybe make themselves more aware of what can happen. And your story is certainly one that would show that.
Well, I know, it is amazing because, I mean, I don't believe in divorce. I would never have considered divorce because, I mean, you know, marriage is a fluctuating fluctuating thing, and you know, you have a stormy, what, a rocky May and June, and then September and October things sure. are hunky dory again.
Yeah, that's right.
And that's the way I looked at it, and I would never consider anyway because of the children, the damage it would do to my three children, and who now are irreparably damaged. But I've since run into a lot of guys who've just lost all contact with their children. Individuals who've never done anything wrong, never been accused of doing anything wrong, let alone found guilty by a jury, which were all meant to be entitled to jury trials. But you know, I've just lost all contact with their children. I've had their children stolen by these criminals. Occasionally, I've heard of them running into them socially, and these children turning on their heel. So they're obviously brainwashed and poisoned, and it'll be a miracle if mine aren't similarly afflicted.
Yes, yes.
So what's got to happen? Well, I don't know. I certainly wouldn't. I can't recommend any legal course of action because I don't think there's no the corrupt courts. So you can do whatever. You can spend it. You can throw half. And I've heard of a bloke who spent $500,000 on it, which is what you know.
And still get nowhere.
Well, he might have got his child. That was the whole point of it. Not many of us got $500,000.
Yes, that's right.
And I can't recommend you do anything apart from try and ignore it all. But it's easier said than done.
Throughout all this, have you ever thought about linking up with any of the fathers' groups that are fighting for change? Or you obviously are articulate to be able to put your story out there. And to have you ever thought about being of some assistance in that way?
Well, I'm on a couple of email things.
Oh, okay.
And I go to sort of local mob, local group who meet every month just to get a bit of social contact. But
yes,
I really don't think there's much we can do. And it's sort of, I think it's a bit demeaning people in our position going cap in hand to legislators begging them to stop stealing our children.
Yes, I agree.
I think it's a bit more serious than that. We've got to these people have got to realise there are going to be consequences if they do it, and they're going to be very dire consequences. And I don't know how long they expect to get away with it, but I have thought of trying to start an underground press, something like that. And I've put out a couple, but I think we sold about one copy at the last thing. So I'm not quite sure the best way to do it.
It's difficult.
I noticed sending something to my local member about it, and the only time you ever get a response is before an election.
Yes.
And you get so I think it's a waste of time. I mean, I think I'm not sure whether they know what goes on. Most people have got no idea what.
No, that's part of the problem, and the legislators are representative of the community who was also in the dark about what's going on.
But you know, legislators, yeah. They're all about power, and this is
yeah,
power,
well, that's true.
And then no one's going to relinquish power willingly. So it's going to take a hell of a excuse my French shit fight, I think. Before anything's done, and when that happens, God only knows.
Yeah, Rick, you've been a fascinating guest. We thank you for joining us on the program today to tell us your horrific story, and hope that all those parents out there who think it could never happen to them have received a much needed wake up call. Thank you very much, and good luck. And we hope that one day you will be reunited with your children.
I wish I could say it was a pleasure, Peter, but thanks anyway.
We thank you.
That was part two of a two-part interview with the dispossessed father of three, Rick. Not his real name for legal reasons, and we hope to have demonstrated the real danger of entering the family justice system in a futile attempt to seek justice and the human rights for you and your children. We'll be back after the break.
If you are a child in a one-parent home, the thoughts that you think may not be your own. When you're old enough, independent of thought, search for your lost parent, challenge what you were taught. You may have a family who is loving and kind, whose true lies and deception have been wiped from your mind. It's not your fault this injustice occurred, so search for your family and don't be deterred. Kept as a hostage to the truth you were blind, so try and make contact for your own peace of mind. Grandparents and other family have all disappeared. They've all been prevented from becoming indeed. You have the right to discover for yourself that half of your family who was stolen by stealth. One day you may have children of your own. They'll ask about that family, the one you should have known. It's not your fault this injustice occurred, so search for your family and don't be deterred. Kept as a hostage to the truth you were blind, so try and make contact for your own peace of mind. Children of your own, they'll ask about that family, the one you should have known. It's not your fault this injustice occurred, so search for your family and don't be deterred. Kept as a hostage to the truth you were blind, so try and make contact for your own peace of mind. It's not your fault this injustice occurred, so search for your family and don't be deterred. Kept as a hostage to the truth you were blind, so try and make contact for your own peace of mind. Search for your family, for your own peace of mind, try and make contact.
They grow so fast. You have to cherish every moment.
Please, Daddy.
You have a right to be involved in the life of your child.
What do you care? It's not like you were ever there anyway.
Dads in Distress meet in your area every week. If you're a non-custodian parent and would like to know who to contact or just want someone to talk to, help is just a phone call away. Dads in Distress, 1300 853 437, or dadsindistress.asn.au.
We're back with Dads on the Air.
And welcome back to Dads on the Air this 23rd day of March 2010. And so I'm Bill Cable from Mediate Now, and in the studio we have Ian Purdy from ianpurdy.com, and we welcome back Phil York from Dads in Distress.
Good morning, Bill. Good morning, Ian. Good morning, everyone. It's great to be back.
Yeah, we haven't seen Phil for a few weeks while he's been working through a few matters, but it's always good to see him, and he's an excellent representative of that sterling organisation, Dads in Distress. So we might throw to Phil straight away. I think you've got a story you wanted to mention, Phil.
And yes, I do. Thanks, Bill. As you said, Dads in Distress is a wonderful organisation. We save many lives, both directly and indirectly, each week, each year. We are partially funded by the federal government to run groups in certain areas of Australia. But what we're not funded for is the great work that we do on our 1300 number. Now, this is a number that took over 4,000 calls, with the average call lasting 40 minutes. So it's not just guys ringing up saying, oh, where's my local group? It's guys that are ringing up in crisis and looking for support. So it's a very important line that we have been funding purely from donations. Now, we have partnered with a wonderful organisation in Sydney known as Networking for Charities, and between the two of us we have organised a walkathon to raise funds for the 1300 number. Now this walkathon will be held in Centennial Park on Sunday, April 11, and the walk is 20 kilometres long, although you don't need to do the whole 20 kilometres. I'll be there trying my best to do the 20, but I must say I'm not a walker or a runner, but I'll see how we go. But obviously it's all about doing it for the cause, and the cause is to keep that 1300 number open and running. There was a period there last year, back in July last year, where our donation pool was quite small, and there was real concerns about whether this 1300 number would continue. But obviously with the traffic that we get of over 4,000 calls in 12 months, excuse me, it is quite obvious to us that this is a very worthwhile service, and lots of people get great support and information from ringing up this service.
Well, you're saving lives. I mean, you're absolutely at the coalface, and I mean, Dads in Distress has saved numerous numbers of men, and we've even played live recordings of you guys actually in the act of saving people's lives, and there's no question that the phone line is of immense, immeasurable value to the society.
Now, Phil, this walk in Centennial Park, it's the week after Easter.
Yep.
What time is it on, and can you give us some details as to what people should do if they want to participate?
Yep, sure, thanks. There are two starting times. The first starting time is 8 a.m., and there is also a second starting time at 10 a.m.
That's for the fast walkers, the people who think they can catch up.
Yeah,
that's the slow people get there at 8:30.
I think I should start it at about 6.
Yeah, I might start the night before, actually.
Yes. And where we're meeting is the church grounds, which is located between Randwick Gates and Govett Street Gates. All this information, if you prefer to email me or phone me, I can pass you on the information. My phone number is 0401 426 101, and from there I can email you information. There is a registration cost of $40 per person, which includes a free hat and water bottle. That registration cost also goes along into the fundraising. We are also looking for sponsors. So there'll be teams of people doing this walk, and we'll be looking for sponsorship to pay us a certain amount of money per kilometre that we walk. Now, you can go on to Networking for Charities website and follow the links for the Dads in Distress Walkathon, and there'll be far more information there. So please come along. If you want to do the walk, if you're a walker yourself, come along and join us at Centennial Park. It'll be a wonderful day. There is a free barbecue after it for all participants. And let's get together to make this a success. As the media release says, saving lives is a walk in the park. You know, it's as simple as that. You spend a morning with us, and you've contributed to helping save lives.
So can you register on the day, Phil, for this for the walk?
Yes, you can register on the day. We would prefer registry prior to that, but if you can only get there on the day, that's fine as well. But for any further information, as I said, I hope everyone's got a pen handy. You can call me on 0401 426 101.
Yes, well, I'm a regular at Centennial Park on a Sunday morning, and there's the Million Paws Walk, and there are a few other walks. I think this one would have to be the most worthwhile. So, yeah, let's get behind it, and let's get these dads who have all these problems. This is one practical way you can do something about it. So let's hope that we get the crowds down there on that the Sunday, the first Sunday after Easter.
Yeah, should be a good day out, and with the barbecue afterwards. You know, a great way to meet people and, yeah, just to get together to support a very, very worthwhile cause.
Yeah, absolutely. Thank you.
Okay. Well, I've actually got an article here. This is as has appeared in the Herald Sun on the 23rd of February. It's a bit of an old one. But it says, moving north, bad for the marriage. Victorian couples contemplating a new life in Queensland, beware, your marriage may not survive the move. Brisbane is Australia's divorce capital, with the city's federal magistrates court processing nearly 10,000 divorce applications last financial year. That's well above any other city, despite the fact Brisbane's population is less than half the size of Melbourne's and Sydney's. So a bit of a sad statistic there for those north of the border. Experts link Queensland's high divorce rate to new arrivals from interstate buckling under the pressure from starting over. Social commentator Mark McCrindle said the upheaval of moving tested many marriages. With the move comes the sea change, the new life, the new career, the new house, and the new focus, he said. It can easily strain the marriage, but also when people are changing so much about their circumstances, a divorce may also work with that. So you just change everything. You change your house, you change your partner, you change, you know, inherit someone else's kids or something. Anyway, that's a bit of a sad state north of the border. Following that up on yesterday was an article in the Courier Mail from Brisbane, written by Alex Tilbury. Divorce has a major financial impact, he warns, and it doesn't matter who paid for what when you separate assets. Everything is considered part of the matrimonial pool, superannuation, your prized golf clubs, even cutlery inherited from your grandmother. Is up for grabs. Latest data from Australian Bureau of Statistics shows there are about 47,000 divorces granted each year in Australia, and that doesn't include breakups among de facto couples. Between a third and a half of all marriages end in divorce. Getting the divorce itself costs very little. There are divorce kits available free at the courts. They are relatively easy to complete, and you may not even need a lawyer. But what is expensive is going to court to resolve parenting and property entitlement disputes. This is something that we here at Dads on the Air advise everybody against. If you can possibly avoid going to the family court, don't set foot in the place. If there's any alternative, grab it and just don't go near there. Yes. The costs are listed here. Sorry, you're going to say something?
Oh, yes, just on that point, I'd have to agree, and it's always been the case. I mean, when Lionel Murphy introduced the changes to family law in 1975, he dealt with the easy bit, the quick divorce after 12 months, but the main issues...
No-fault divorce.
Yeah. Yes, the main issues have always been the property and the children, and they're still the main issues today.
Yeah, well, this article goes on to say, if your split can't be resolved by agreement, don't expect the legal fees to be less than $20,000 for each of you. The average cost is probably about $30,000 to $40,000 each. Obviously, the best way to keep costs down is to avoid long, drawn-out court battles. Commercial law firm Kelly & Co. partner and family law specialist David Jenkins says hostility between parties results in funds being swallowed up in lengthy and avoidable court action. Court action should be reviewed as the last resort for parties going through a divorce, he says. It can be a very expensive and drawn-out process, particularly if the former partners are bitter. It's not just the financial costs of undertaking court action, but the time and the emotional impact on the individuals themselves, and of course the impact on any children who may be involved can often be even more devastating than it is on the parents, who at least get the satisfaction of being able to slag each other off in front of men wearing dresses with and false hair.
Well, interesting that the lawyer would say get out of court, but I'd have to agree with that and put in a plug for mediation. If there's any way of resolving this through mediation rather than going through the court and having someone else make the decision, go for it.
Yeah, don't go to court if you can possibly avoid it. And as we say here, the best thing to do if you are the victim of a divorce or a family separation, or if you're the instigator or whatever, as a father, the man wearing the trousers, you're better off to come up with a settlement while you're still in the family home, where you can negotiate equally with your partner across the table, preferably not in front of the children, and get your divorce settlement or your breakup settlement, whatever you want to call it, organized before you leave the home. Otherwise, once you're gone, you're gone. You've got no rights, as we just heard in that Peter van der Voort interview with Rick. Once you leave the family home, you have no rights. You have no rights to anything. You cannot assume that you have any rights, and any such assumptions will be shown to be completely naive and completely stupid. So on that happy note, I think we'll go to a track. This is Horizon Shine, Shaving in a Basin Full of Tears.
My worst fears. call me dad. I don't know what I did. I don't know where I went wrong. And now I'm all alone, singing this sad song. Now I'm shaving in a basin full of tears. I've been cut, but I ain't bleeding. I'm shaving in a basin full of tears. My children have been taken away. I'm alone with my worst fears.
Dads in Distress, meeting your area every week. If you're a non-custodian parent and would like to know who to contact or just want someone to talk to, help is just a phone call away. Dads in Distress, 1300 853 437, or dadsindistress.asn.au.
We're back with Dads on the Air.
Welcome back to Dads on the Air. And in the studio we have Phil York from Dads in Distress. Phil, I believe there's been some success achieved by Dids recently.
Yeah, there was some very exciting news about 3 or 4 weeks ago, Bill. As our listeners may know, there's a short film festival known as Tropfest, which is very popular. They have live stream screenings all around Australia on a particular night in February. Lots of entries, over 700 entries in this year's short film festival. And Dads in Distress partnered with Southern Cross 10 and or a producer from Southern Cross 10 and produced a short film in regards to our meetings. It was called Every Second Weekend, and we were fortunate enough to get into the finals.
That's a fantastic effort. And I know the Sun Herald produced a free DVD, I think, of the finalists. So anyone
that's
has
right.
still got that DVD, you might like to get it out and have another look at the Dads in Distress contribution.
Yeah, it was great. It took 5 weeks of filming to capture all the material that was needed. There is going to be a longer version of this film as well, but the editing and the way that it was put together by the producer was absolutely spectacular. I was there on the night down at the Domain, and it was shown down there as in every state, and it was wonderful. It was fantastic, and it certainly opened up the eyes and the minds of everyone who saw it.
That's what it's all about. And we might give a cheerio call to Tony Miller, the founder of Dads in Distress, and just congratulate him once again for the fantastic work he's done with that organisation over the years.
Absolutely. Well, we seem to be getting to the end of yet another edition of Dads on the Air. This show will be available on our website, dadsontheair.net, from sometime this afternoon. You'll be able to listen to it all again if you so desire, and we'll all be back again next week.
Yes, I can hear the music warming up, and don't forget, following us is Country On with our own Country Bob.
That's it. Don't know why he thinks he's a country old Bob. He's not that big a bloke.
He's got his 40-gallon hat on today.
He sure has.
We should have the video going.
Yeah, Bob and the Bob will be in the saddle.
We're here cause we care. We ask all the questions that others don't dare. We're dads on the air. We're dads on the air.